And just for clarification, before we begin the argument, we have elected not to accept the supplemental authorities that you submitted, Mr. Crane. Just to make sure that, since we hadn't issued a formal ruling on that, I just didn't want there to be any misunderstanding about the status of that motion. And with that, I noticed that the bailiff informed us that you're on crutches, Mr. Klein. Well, if you wish to remain at council table, or if it becomes difficult at the podium and you wish to sit down, we will not construe that as early ending of your argument. So it's, the option is yours. If you wish to sit down, that's fine with us. Okay, so please begin.
Good afternoon, may it please the court. My name is Eric Klein, attorney registration number 42185, and I represent Mr. Tony Singleton in this criminal appeal. I would like to focus our argument today on the first two issues raised in our brief, the erroneous denials of three challenges for cause and the erroneous removal of a sitting juror. This court and the Colorado Supreme Court have set forth very clearly the standard for removal for a juror for cause. The Supreme Court said in Naylor, if there is sufficient reason to question the impartiality of the juror, the trial court should grant a challenge for cause and dismiss the juror. This court said in People v. Wilson, reversible error occurs when a trial court does not grant a challenge for cause to a prospective juror who expresses doubt about his or her ability to be impartial and is not rehabilitated by the prosecution or the trial court. And, Your Honor, that is exactly what happened here. I'd like to start with Juror E.C. And Juror E.C. expressed clear doubt about her ability to be impartial, and she was never rehabilitated. Twice, Juror E.C. was directly asked, and twice she said she did not know if she could be impartial. And finally, she said the second time, I can try my best, but I don't know. Juror E.C. said this in light of her experience working for Denver Public Schools, in light of the fact that the allegations in this case involved a child. She said this at the end of a lengthy voir dire, and after having been advised by a trial court about the presumption of innocence, about standard of proof, about judging credibility, and about being sure not to allow passion or sympathy to enter into any decision. And she said this after defense counsel had at length questioned jurors about their ability to follow these principles of law.
Mr. Klein, excuse me, I'd like to ask you to compare that juror's response to the response of the juror in the Morrison case, which I believe cited in the briefs. In that case, the juror said, the court asked, is there anything about the case that would not allow you to be fair and impartial in viewing the evidence? And the juror answered, you know, in all honesty, I really don't know, and then expressed some concerns as a parent about the nature of the charges involving children in that case. But I am not clear, and maybe you can explain how that answer, I really don't know, differs from the answer that the juror gave in this case.
And I'm sorry, because actually Morris is not one of the cases that's sharpest in my mind, but I believe that there was other statements, and I know the court will correct me if I'm wrong, there were other statements by the juror indicating an ability to follow the court's instructions and to follow the principles of law.
Well, later the court notes that the juror said that she would, her feelings would probably not interfere with her ability to listen to the evidence, and that she believed that she could listen to the evidence. They assumed that those responses were inconsistent with her earlier statement that, but they finally noted the record provides no affirmative basis for us to conclude that the trial court's assessment was erroneous.
And I think, Your Honor, that is that situation of inconsistent or self-contradictory statements where a trial court's discretion, a trial court's on-the-scene interpretation does come into play more. Here we have no such statements by the juror. Here we solely have the juror saying, I don't know if I can be fair and impartial. There never was any rehabilitation. There never was any sort of contradictory statement. And I think that's what sets this apart, and that's what makes this more like Naylor, where the juror said, I don't think I could be fair, or Wilson, where the juror said that the defendant had a strike against him. This court has stressed recently the importance and the ease of rehabilitation. In Hancock, the court discussed at length how simple that can be and how important that is. What the Supreme Court has stressed, I believe in Naylor, again, was the final position of the juror is what matters. And in this case, the final position of the juror was that she expressed doubt about her ability to be fair. I think it's important that the trial court actually, as defense counsel was questioning Juror EC about her ability to be fair, told defense counsel to wrap it up at that point and basically cut off any ability to delve further into that. And then there was no further questioning by either the trial court or by the prosecution to try to rehabilitate this juror. And I think that's what sets this in a different position, because the final position of that juror was that she expressed a doubt about her ability to be fair.
But when she says, I believe I can be fair, but I'm not sure, is that not an internally inconsistent sentence, even though it's the final position?
I don't think that Jury C ever said, I believe I can be fair, but I'm not sure.
I just thought I can try to be fair, but I'm not sure if I can, or I don't know if I can, or something like that.
She actually said, well, I can try my best.
Right. I think, as she said, I will try my best, but I don't know if I can. That's different from saying, I think I can, I'm pretty sure. That is more consistent with the Naylor juror saying, I don't think I can be fair. There was a colloquy between defense counsel and Juror EC asking her about her ability to be fair, asking her about her involvement with Denver Public Schools and whether that would cause her to feel this way because of the involvement with a child. And that is, I'm sorry, actually that was Juror KS more than Juror EC, because as soon as defense counsel got into questioning Juror EC, that is when the trial court said, you need to wrap it up.
I'm just trying to explore the limits of the answer. Would your answer be different if the juror had said, I'll try my best to be fair, but I don't know if I can until I'm actually on the jury? Would that be a different situation or the same in your view?
I think if the juror had said that in conjunction with, I can follow the court's instructions and I'll see once I'm on the jury, because certain cases talk about a juror kind of giving a more qualified answer of, once I see what the evidence is, I'll evaluate what the evidence is. But here there never was any such thing. So I will give a qualified that may have been, I think that may have been different. But I do think there needed to be some expression of a juror. In Lumen, this court said that when a juror expresses doubt about her ability to be fair, she must be struck in the absence of unequivocal statements by the juror of her commitment to fairness. And here we have, I submit, a clear expression of doubt about her ability to be fair, and never any such unequivocal statement of her commitment to fairness. And that is what's lacking in this case for Juror EC.
Now, let me ask you about that, because you did not use a peremptory strike on EC. And so what we're the standard that we're reviewing under here is whether you were denied a fair and impartial jury. Should it matter to us that you did not strike this witness, or excuse me, this juror, with full knowledge of all of this, and apparently left her on as an alternate?
Right. Well, I think that's key, Your Honor. I think the as an alternate in what was expected to be a 2 to 3 day trial, and actually I think segues somewhat into our second issue, which if the court was to talk about that, I'm happy to. I'd rather not get there just yet.
Okay.
But the fact that she was an alternate, I think that under Morrison, that the calculus of whether the denial of the challenge was an abuse of discretion is the same. I think it actually takes out the McCranger issue of what's cert has recently been granted on, because this juror did end up deliberating. But I think that Your Honor, with the last statement about this being alternate, hit the nail on the head. The defense counsel obviously made the discretionary call to use strikes on people who would likely be deliberating in what was a rather short trial. I would like to
So the denial here of a fair and impartial jury is premised on this person. It would be an abuse of discretion for the court to have let this juror sit because of her equivocation.
Yes, I would say it's beyond equivocation. She expressed a doubt about her ability to be fair, and I do think that if it was equivocation, it would have been a different situation. Where she said, I don't know if I can be fair, that is a far different situation. And I submit that, as this court pointed out in Hancock, rehabilitation, some degree of follow-up, would not have been very difficult for the trial court to engage in. The trial court kind of indicated that it was in a rush to get this jury impaneled and to get to trial, and as evidenced by indicating to trial counsel to wrap it up. I would like to take a minute and just talk about Juror KS as well, because Juror KS made a clear statement saying, initially, all I want to do is go for the victim. There was a lengthy colloquy between Juror KS and defense counsel in which her final position was that she would not, that she would be better on a different case, was the way she put it. There was defense counsel indicated her body language was very uncomfortable. There was, again, nothing inconsistent or self-contradictory from Juror KS about her stating that all she wants to do, initially all she wants to do, is go for the victim, and she, again, was never rehabilitated. And I submit this is similar to the juror in Wilson who indicated that the defendant had a strike against him. It's similar to the juror in Merrow who talked about that she could not credit or judge credibility of somebody who was a drug user. And because for Juror KS, we get into issues other than just being fair and impartial, other than just abiding by the court's instructions regarding the presumption of innocence and the standard and burden of proof, we get into issues of judging witness credibility. And in a case like this, where the alleged victim was the critical witness, when this juror starts off by saying, initially, all I want to do is go for the victim, and is never questioned to say, despite that initial feeling, could you set that aside and judge the victim's credibility fairly? If we had such a rehabilitation, I wouldn't be here talking about Juror KS.
Mr. Klein, go ahead.
Mr. Klein, I'm a little concerned with the way Juror KS was voir dired. She's not asked, except in one instance that I see in the record, whether she could be fair and impartial. She's asked if she could be a good juror. I'm not sure that juror understands when she's asked, can you be a good juror, if that means can you be fair and impartial. When she's asked that direct question, can you be fair and impartial, she says, I do my best to be fair. But that's not to say that I wouldn't try, or the way I feel about my experiences as a social worker would be fair. Well, I'm not certain in my mind that that is an indication that she would be biased.
And Your Honor, I think it's a very valid point with Juror KS. I think that the initial thing that Juror KS saying that her initial position is all she wants to do is go for the victim raises issues about judging credibility. I do agree that it's not the clearest questioning of Juror KS, but this court has said repeatedly, I believe, that it's on the prosecution and the trial court at that point to rehabilitate. So if there was a question about Juror KS, can you set aside your feelings and be fair and impartial, that was the burden of the trial court and the prosecution to rehabilitate. And Judge Graham, if I've answered your question, if there's no other questions, I would like to reserve the last 2 minutes, 50 seconds for rebuttal.
You have 2 minutes and 48 seconds.
Thank you.
May it please the court, my name is Ryan Crane. I'm representing the people in this case. My attorney registration number is 37842. As I think the court's questions have already highlighted, what's important for us to remember here is the standard of review with which we analyze a trial court's decisions in cases like this, where a cold record can present a very different picture from what a trial court actually sees at trial when viewing a juror's demeanor, tone, or body language when answering these questions. And that's especially true in cases like this, where you have somewhat equivocal statements and a juror saying things like, I will do my best to be fair, and at the same time, I don't know if I can be fair, can be read in pretty different ways. For example, if a juror says, I will do my best to be fair, but I don't know, jurors often don't know, and they feel somewhat, as this court is aware, we see these kind of answers all the time because jurors are brought into a courtroom. It's a formal environment. They've got this weighty decision they're being told they're going to have to make about questions like child prostitution, and they think, dear God, this is a terrifying experience, and I don't know what I'm going to hear, what kind of strange or scary or offensive scenarios am I going to hear. You know, I don't know what it's going to be like when I hear all of this, but what we usually look at and what this court has and the Supreme Court has looked at, it said, if there's some basis on which to affirm the trial court and there's not an affirmative demonstration that the trial court abused its discretion, making an manifestly arbitrary, unreasonable, or unfair decision, we affirm, and we have to defer to the trial court's understanding of the jurors speaking in person.
Yes, Mr. Crane, excuse me for interrupting you, but
no, absolutely.
You raise a good point about the trial judge being in the best position to look at the demeanor of the jurors or yes. prospective jurors. And here, the only indication we have on this cold record is that even the trial court didn't like the demeanor of one of the jurors in terms of being fair to the defendant, because the trial court said, I didn't hear anything stated specifically from this juror that she couldn't be fair and impartial in this. I do understand her demeanor is one that you probably don't want to be on this jury. Doesn't that in itself raise an obligation on the part of the trial judge to look at that juror and say, look, Ms. X, can you be fair and impartial? Can you go back and render a fair and impartial verdict in this case?
I think it would perhaps be helpful, especially after a trial court comment like that, and we would have an easier job on appeal to say, well, what was that demeanor and what did the trial judge decide about that demeanor? Ultimately, though, we're left with the record we have, and there's not a requirement that the trial court absolutely go back and explain the details. What we do know is the trial court was presented squarely with the question of this juror's demeanor and recognized, I see the demeanor as maybe not one you don't want on the jury, but what the trial court didn't find is, I find that her demeanor shows she's fair, she's unfair, or she's hostile to the defense, or she can't hear the evidence fairly, or she's biased, or something like that. The trial court's comment indicates, I see the demeanor, and I see why maybe defense counsel, you might want to use a peremptory strike against that juror, but by the trial court making that comment, and based on the equivocal statements we have, and the juror not raising her hand when she was asked by the prosecutor, anyone who cannot be fair, the juror did not raise her hand. Based on all that, we have to go with the trial court's assessment of the demeanor, even though the trial court's comment was recognizing, well, it may not be one that the defense wants on the jury.
Mr. Crane, I understand the standard of review and giving the trial court deference on questions of demeanor, but Mr. Klein made a point toward the end of his argument. He said it's on the prosecution, the burden's on the prosecution and the trial court to rehabilitate. What is your response to that portion of Mr. Klein's argument?
Well, my response is that the case law is clear that we look at the entire record of the voir dire. The Naylor, 1980 Colorado Supreme Court case that was cited, talking about the final position of the juror. I think the final position, as I've seen that case followed later, is a factor to consider. It hasn't been treated in more recent decisions by this court or the Colorado Supreme Court as the be-all, end-all of whether or not a trial court abused its discretion. And so I hope that's an answer to your question in that rehabilitation is helpful. It can provide more information for us. But when you have equivocal statements and things supporting both, providing some support for the trial court's decision, we have the entire record before us, and that's what we have.
I understand that your comment that the final word isn't determinative. I know there's an old case, Zarinko, that used to be interpreted that the final word was what they go on, and I understand that I don't necessarily accept that articulation. But when you have... There's two different situations. You can have strong answers and strong answers here that are contrasting,
sure.
Or you can have a total sort of unequivocal responses, and you have to decide what those mean. And can you discern a difference in those, and would the burden be different in those two situations?
Where you have completely contradictory statements versus where you just have kind of this non-committal response of,
exactly.
Oh, I don't really know.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's a good question, and they are different scenarios. I think in either case, it calls for us to say, well, the trial court assessed it. And if we don't have something in those cases where we've got nothing but a sort of non-committal response, there can be a lot communicated through tone, as I emphasized earlier. And so to say, you know, I don't know, but a demeanor and tone, they emphasize a lot more that I'm really saying yes, rather than I really truly don't know and can't commit to anything. And so under the facts of this case, when we've got, for example, juror EC saying, I'm going to try my best and I don't know, that is sufficient to say yes, trial court, especially in light of the fact that when asked directly, hey, anyone here who cannot be fair and impartial, this is a child prostitution case, presumption of innocence, et cetera, didn't raise her hand, that's enough to affirm the trial court's exercise of discretion. I think we've got a similar situation with respect to juror KS, and I won't go any further at this point. If the court doesn't have any further questions, I'll be happy to sit down and ask that the court affirm and thank the court for its time.
Thank you, Mr. Clark.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'd like to focus on two points raised by Mr. Crane, one being the abuse of discretion standard. And as this court has stated very clearly in Wilson, the abuse of discretion standard does not mean that this court abdicates its responsibility of appellate review. And I submit that the abuse of discretion standard is the deference to the trial court is there for two main reasons. One is the trial court is in the best position to judge credibility, and that the other is that the trial court is in the best position to judge demeanor. In this case, there was no question of credibility. There's no credibility findings, as in Hancock, to which this court must defer. The jurors stated their doubts about their ability to be fair. There was never any statement after that about, such as, I can still follow the court's instructions, at which point the trial court could say, well, I believe the jury when they say they can follow my instructions, as opposed to their earlier statement about not being sure they could be fair. And as Judge Graham pointed out, as far as demeanor, the trial court pointed out specifically with juror EC that her demeanor was one the defense, I care if that's as hostile, he did not use that word, it was one the defense would not one on the jury, although the trial court referenced discomfort of other jurors, never made such a clear statement. And so here, I submit there's not a need for such deference. Additionally, the trial court applied a standard of that's the best we can expect from her. That's what the trial court said with juror KS, which is, of course, not the standard. The standard where a juror has expressed doubt about her ability to be fair is unequivocal commitment to fairness. I'd also like to address the point that Mr. Crane made about the lack of any response to when the prosecutor said some general statement about would anybody for any reason be unable to follow the law. In Mello, the trial court asked almost the exact same question. The trial court went through the principles of law, the presumption of innocence, the burden of proof, reasonable doubt, and the determination of credibility, and then asked, does anybody feel that they would have problems generally following these instructions? And none of the potential jurors responded. And so in Mello, it was the exact same situation, and this court did not hold that that was in some way a contradictory response. Indeed, in this very case, when the prosecutor asked that question, one juror responded, the issues were resolved. Later, on questioning by defense counsel, another juror said, use actually magic words, I can't be fair, or I could not be fair, something along those lines. That juror did not respond to the prosecutor's question, yet nonetheless, later on direct questioning by defense counsel, said I could not be fair. I see that I am out of time. Unless there are any other questions from the court, I would ask that you reverse Mr. Singleton's convictions. Thank you.
Thank you very much to both counsel for your excellent arguments. They're very helpful to the court. The case will stand submitted, and a decision will issue in due course.
Thank you.